positive feedback. Yeah, there's an audio feedback. But there's also a low frequency feedback with a resonant frequency of about 1 hertz. It sounds to me like a fascinating example of, phase margin and control system. That you have a phase, you have a feedback loop, 1 hertz resonant.
Okay, I don't think I could perceive a 1 hertz signal. I don't think my ears are capable of that.
No, the wobbling effect.
Oh, okay, so it has a 1 hertz envelope on it.
Yeah.
Okay, it's interesting that you could find that from a signal that was supposed to be purely nuisance.
It's a nuisance, but it doesn't fit what we want. But in a different world, it might be the two weather noise.
Geez, we're getting rather zen here, aren't we, Ed?
Beauty is in the eye of the beholder.
And I think the other end of that line is that ugliness goes down to the core.
Yeah, but that wasn't the point I was trying to make. I'm saying it's all based on your perspective.
That's true, but, random noise ultimately is just random noise. We could read a lot into it, but it would probably be more indicative of ourselves than the random noise.
Wait a minute. This is semantically important. I don't believe I said random. My reference to noise is not random noise implies Gaussian receiver hiss. I'm saying noise as in other room, my wife is listening to the television. To me, it is noise. To her, it is a very coherent signal.
Okay, I just extrapolated ad absurdum. That was the only thing that I was doing there.
Yeah, but I meant that in some situations, our conversation might be the noise, and somebody might be fascinated by that weird sound.
I am sure that that is the case. Maybe not tonight, but every so often we have some curious people checking into our net where I think they'd rather listen to that noise than us.
Wait. Again, everything is relevant. I think it may be that we're that fast.
Not necessarily. It's neither good nor bad. They may know what we are talking about, but they're more interested in the stuff that is not what we're talking about. Yeah, it's different flow. Whatever floats one's boat, as the old line goes. Whatever amuses you. If you don't find pleasure with the technical net, there are many, many, many billion other ways of spending your time. I don't feel slighted if someone decides that they'd rather watch or listen or read a book.
Isn't the expression "whatever floats your boat" credited to Archimedes?
I do not believe so. I think it actually has a more obscene ideology.
Know where I was going with that question.
Yes, Eureka.
I mean, if anybody understood what makes a boat float, Archimedes is the one who figured it out first.
Well, he's certainly very famous for it, and unfortunately, that brings up a little thing. About 3-4 weeks ago, Rich, who just got back from Israel, I hope he enjoyed himself if you're out there, W2BZ, asked me my opinion of Amazon's new Ring of Powers. In which one of the dumbest things I've ever heard was put into the script, where the kid has a paper boat that's floating, and kids throw rocks at it, and it falls into the little river, and her older brother tells her, why boats float and rocks sink? It's because boats look up and rocks look down. So apparently he had not heard of Archimedes, and the writer may not have heard of Archimedes either.
That just sounds stupid, too.
Well, you've summed up Amazon's multi-billion dollar effort. It is the dumbest show I have ever seen portions of. The writing is abysmal. It's practically a graduate-level course in how not to write a story, either for movies or for television. It's just incredibly badly done. It's remarkable what $1 billion and a bunch of incompetent idiots can produce.
$1 billion will attract incompetent idiots.
Well, yeah, I mean, $1 billion will attract pretty much anyone and everyone, but unfortunately, I guess they decided to go with completely unproven people. Hollywood is a very, very weird place. They got an okay from J.J. Abrams, if you're familiar with his work. He has pretty much screwed up Star Wars and Star Trek, and I don't know what he's moving on to screwing up now, but... These showrunners and writers have next to no credits. They wrote a failed script for a Star Trek movie that was never produced. So, of course, you throw $1 billion because, you know, Jeff Bezos has a lot more of those in the back room. So it's, it's terrible. I mean, if you ever want to be amused, watch a review of the show. Certainly don't watch the show.
I was unaware of its very existence about a minute ago.
Well, you are very fortunate in that. It's very difficult to miss it because if you ever get any Amazon products, they're promoting it in just about every box I get from them.
I get stuff from Amazon regularly, and I've still not seen it. No. Maybe they either like me or don't like me more or less than they like you.
That's a possibility. Well, they have two general packages. Well, they have two cardboard packages. One is the regular cardboard stock, and the other, for some odd reason, is colored blue. And the one that's colored blue is just all over the place with Lord of Rings, Rings of Power. So consider yourself lucky that you missed it entirely. This season is over, but, like many terrible things, it's coming back in a couple of years for season two. Jeff hasn't flushed enough money down the toilet.
Hey, on the box, I do recall seeing a blue box. I think there's something about that, but it wasn't cardboard. It was when they had delivery trucks.
Well, yeah, I'm sure they painted up their trucks as well, because they have their own vans. Sometimes I get it from FedEx and from the UPS, but a lot of times it's their own delivery service. So, yeah, they've been promoting it up, down, and all around. They've been paying off magazines to write shill articles that it's the greatest television show ever made in mankind's history.
I just looked at the truck. Shrugged my shoulders and said, I give up.
Well, the way that I look on it, I need to know what the enemy is has in store for us all. So I try and keep a finger in the common culture. As it is, I go through magazines and I look at the names and pictures and I say, who the hell are these people? Usually they're reality stars, which I don't even understand the concept of that term, but there is that term, and it's used rather all over the place. There's a lot of strange people who walk around and call themselves reality stars.
The movie about a year ago, Don't Look Up, I think it was on Netflix or nowhere else or whatever, Don't Look Up.
No, I've heard good things about it. It's on my list of movies when I get a chance to take a look at. Have you seen it? Did you enjoy it?
Yes, absolutely, on both counts. And it's exactly what you're talking about, how serious, really serious stuff, this nonsense. end. I saw it. You got to see this one, Roy.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, don't take it literally. It's a metaphor for so many things. It just illustrates the principle.
Okay, very good. Thank you. I appreciate it. Yeah, I mean, there are so many things I want to read, so many things I want to watch, and so little time. I think you were talking earlier about Time Machine. That would be something I would love to get. I've Googled it and queried it on Amazon. They don't seem to manufacture them yet. Maybe someday. I need to squeeze an extra hour in each day.
Hold on, wait a minute. Paul, do you agree with me that the ending, the post-ending, I hate it?
It's awful, but I got a laugh out of it, that's about it. The whole movie was very good, though. The ending, very strange, but good for a laugh.
I'm just saying, the ending went off on a complete tangent to Never Never Land, and it didn't work.
Yeah, I agree. Well, they had the one guy, he was like an Elon Musk type of guy. Whatever, you know, what would happen if, you know, you had enough money and you could, you know, you find yourself 10,000 years into the future and nothing but trouble anyway. But, I don't know. It was a good ending, very strange.
No, I call it the post-ending. Roy, when you get to the real ending, feel free to stop.
Well, you've engaged my curiosity, which is always a dangerous thing, so I'll see if I recall that when I get to the end. Thanks a lot, Ed, and thank you to Paul, and thanks to everyone who participated tonight. We're running into SpaceNet time, so without much ado, let me summon forth Paul WS2N with the SpaceNet report.
Can I rudely interrupt and ask for another minute?
Certainly, Ed. You could always do that.
There was a movie made, I don't know, about 20 years ago, Night at the Museum, that I thought was absolutely adorable. Apparently, a lot of other people did, too, and they made a sequel of it. And in the sequel, there is a point where a modern-day, at the time anyway, cell phone, gets transported back to the end of World War II in Times Square. You know, a big Times Square celebration with a sailor kiss, the nurse in the picture. The cell phone ends up there. And then the movie ends. And then that's the only area. But at the end of the movie, the sailor, who's hosting that guy, who picks up the phone, home. He's like, on leave now. Maybe he was, you know, living in Brooklyn in the song, I don't know, but bottom line is trying to figure out what the hell this is. And his mother keeps calling from downstairs, Joey, all the relatives in here come on down to dinner. Says, in a minute, Ma. And says, Joey Motorola, you get down here now.
That's cute. Quantum Leap used to do that a lot. They would have the guy jump into someone in the past and interact with a kid, and the kid would develop some kind of an interest based upon their interaction, and then his name would be mentioned, and he was a famous inventor. There also was a take of that on the original Star Trek. The episode was called A Piece of the Action. It was about a alien planet that was contaminated by an Earth book history of Chicago during the Mafia Wars, and they all ran Mafia type of businesses and government, and the Enterprise landed and did whatever it did, and when they took off, they left behind one of their communicators, and the closing line, Kirk said, you know, they're very imitative. They imitated the book. They're gonna take it apart. They're gonna figure it out. And he said, and then one day they're gonna come to us and they're gonna want a piece of our action. Fade out to the episode. So that's a well used plot. I've enjoyed it many times where it's been used.
I was speaking about the Enterprise, CVN-80.
Yep.
I think they just laid the keel for aircraft carrier CVN 80, USS Enterprise, to replace the one currently being scrapped.
Ah, great. It's good to have an Enterprise. You know, I've been a fan since I was a kid. I remember I watched a rerun. I think it was either the first season or the second season. I unfortunately didn't decide to watch it when it first ran because Lost in Space annoyed the heck out of me so much that I gave up on science fiction for a couple of months. But finally, one summer, I turned it on. And I was took.
By the way, I am sure they came up with that name, which was right after the launch of CVN-5, USS Enterprise, and it was all in the news, and they parlayed it. They keep reusing the name Enterprise, so they used it for the spaceship. But now they're scrapping CVN-5, they laid the keel for CVN-8.
Well, I lost track, but I think Roddenberry was Navy. I know he flew planes, but I think it was for the Navy at the time. So I think he was aware of Enterprise and such, but yeah, it could be.
I was a kid, and I was aware of it.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So, yeah, a surprising number of science fiction writers came from the Navy as opposed to any of the other branches. Robert Heinlein was a Navy officer. L. Ron Hubbard, before he got kicked out, was a Navy officer. And, you know, that's just a few. I'm sure there's a bunch of others that were in the Navy. You know, it seems rather curious coincidence.
Here's my son to that list.
Okay, but he didn't exactly write any science fiction, has he? Maybe he has.
No, literally, my son just wrote a science fiction book, and he distributed on this internet, whatever, where they review each other's science fiction books. I mean, so far, it's just that, nothing more. But he did literally write a science fiction book.
Ah, congratulations. I'm very curious. Do you know what type of science fiction? You know, there's soft science, there's hard science, there's all kinds of categories.
It's based on some stuff that's out there now with various stuff that grew out of video games and Japanese manga and all that. That completely baffles me. But it's like when somebody is sent to another world by some deities that are well-defined but make no sense, where they have magical powers and how they do in this other universe.
Okay, seems very involved. If he ever publishes, let me know.
Will do. I think we should give over Paul.
Yes, that's a very good idea. So, Paul, please, take it away.
And, oh, by the way, there's a remake of Quantum Leap. They're doing it now. I think they're up to the third or fourth episode. Roy, just to let you know. They brought it back to life.
Yeah, I know. Unfortunately, there were a lot of people disappointed that they didn't employ Scott Bakula. They basically did what they always do. They switched races and genders and all kinds of things because they can't leave things alone. So I wish them luck, but I probably would be disappointed if I watched it. I've heard absolutely no buzz about it, so. You know, no one's come on and said it's terrible. No one's come on and said it's great. Just no one talks about it. So that's not a good sign.
Okay. Well, yeah, they refer to, Scott in the show with Sam. They refer to him, you know, quite a few different times. So, you know, he's not in it, but they bring up his name quite often. But, you know, well, he had that run with Enterprise, you know, with the Star Trek show. So people would, most people would recognize him maybe for that show. And then, you know, what's he doing in Quantum Leap? Who knows? Anyway, just to let you know, they made a comeback. like all shows that I've seen probably 20, 30, 40 years ago, they eventually creep back on the tube.
Personally, I'm waiting for my mother the car.
Okay, very good, yeah. Yeah, that rings a bell. Okay, let me go through a couple of space topics here. One thing is, I noticed on your website, roy.ac2gs.com, you had a topic about the satellite, the data recorder that malfunctions. It's the Geotail satellite. I remember talking about that on a couple of times on this net many, many years ago. Anyway, that thing was launched in the early 1990s. But it's on an extremely high orbit. You know, it goes halfway out to the moon, and it comes back around 30,000 miles above the Earth for perigee, and back all the way out again halfway to the moon. And it's been doing this since the early 1990s. But apparently one of the CPUs or something malfunctioned. There's redundancy on all NASA equipment. And Geotail went through one. Now I guess they're going through the other one. It looks like it's probably going to fail. I don't think they could bring it back to life. But they're going to, they're going to try, I mean, it was designed for 20 years, and they got a lot more than that, of course. But interesting thing we talked about on this net was the antennas. It's got these real long wire antennas sticking out. They run, they always say 50 meters on each side, but it's like roughly 300 feet, like the length of a football field. And there's two sets of that, of those. And then there's a couple of, they look like antenna towers that were stretched out, and I think they go around 60 feet or so out on each side. So, and then it spins, And it's an interesting satellite that was launched on a Delta II rocket many, many years ago. So, anybody wants to look that up, it would be on Roy's website. Let me drop it. So, you're talking earlier in the net about putting up a dipole in space. essentially, that's what they did with this. But this thing looks for, it actually detects the plasma, the reactions of that. That type of thing. It's designed to look for the tail, the magnetic tail that comes off the tail end of the Earth, from the sun. So it's been investigating that for forever. I guess they need constant data from not only year to year, but decade to decade. I'm not even sure if there's anything to replace it. Anyway, I thought I'd bring that up for you.
Okay, good.
Okay, there's a space telescope called Euclid. Euclid is being built by the European Space Agency. Their goal was to put this thing out at L2, that's a million miles away from Earth, in the same location where James Webb Space Telescope is located. And this thing is designed, again, to look using infrared, but it's a different, they're looking for different stuff than the James Webb. James Webb is, looking for real high quality pictures of certain phenomena all the way dating back to 13.8 billion years. They can't quite get that far, but they're getting close, a lot further than what Hubble could look at. This thing really looking for that kind of distance, although it will go out to 10 billion years. The idea of Euclid is to really map the universe, map the billions of galaxies, and then from the information over time, they'll be able to tell, you know, the way things are moving, and it'll give the scientists a better idea about not only dark matter, but dark energy. So that's the goal of Euclid. Anyway, the reason I bring it up is they plan on launching this now on an American spacecraft that they're talking to SpaceX to launch on a Falcon 9. And a couple of years ago, it was scheduled to launch on a Russian rocket. But of course, now with the problems with Ukraine, that was crossed off the list. But sure enough, it's going to still go. And this time, and probably within a year, I think they're looking to get it off the ground before the end of next year. And they'll launch on a Falcon 9 rocket and go all the way out to L2. All right, before I move on, any comments? WS2M. They were thinking about launching on an Ariane 5, because, you know, Ariane rockets are launched by European Space Agency, but there's only a couple of those flights left, and that manifest is full, and to wait for Ariane 6 to be put online. Ariane 6 has recently been delayed a little bit more, so they'd like to get this thing up to orbit before that time period. So they're going to go with, they said an American rocket. Well, it looks like Falcon 9 will be what they'll use. I wanted to talk about the EVAs that NASA has canceled since March. The reason they canceled all EVAs on the International Space Station for the American side, not the Russian side, they could still do it, is because, you know, once again, they found water inside of one of the astronauts' helmets. This Matthias Morrow, he was an astronaut that this year, back in March, did an EVA, and when he came back in, there was water in a helmet, and that brought back the 2013 problem when the Italian astronaut had a lot of water in his spacesuit. They were looking to see if it was the same problem or something different. But until they worked on it, they said, that's it, we're canceling all EVAs. That's things that they have to do on the outside of the space station, like finish putting up solar panels and other science that has to be done on the outside of it, and construction that has to still be done on the space station. You know, they said if there's an emergency or an ammonia leak or something like that, we'll do it. But in the meantime, they took that spacesuit, put it inside a Falcon 9 cargo vehicle, and you know, they send down around 4,000 pounds of stuff from the space station every time one of those things go back down. So the Dragon brought it back, and the engineers looked at it, and they determined that's really not that much of a problem. Just, you know, people sweat inside, and some people more so than others. They keep the temperature at, you know, different temperatures on the inside of the suit. Combination of that built up too much humidity, and to the point where it started to fog up his visor. So now they know how to compensate for that for future EVA flights, and now they have approved them to start doing EVAs again, which is good. They have another planned solar panel to be installed. They have to put out all these different truss pieces first, and it takes like 3 EVAs to do it, and eventually later this year or early next year, they'll send up another solar array called the ROSA, R-O-S-A, a rollout solar array that will fly on another cargo Dragon vehicle after it docks to the space station. Robotic arm removes it from the what they call the trunk, the back of the space station, back of the your Dragon cargo vehicle, and they pull it out, and then there'll be ready to install that. So, that, you know, it wasn't as bad as they thought. They thought maybe it might be, you know, more of a major problem with these suits. But they're good to go. Any comments? Okay, another interesting thing. You can see this on in two locations. It's a picture from the James Webb Space Telescope of what they call the pose of creation, which was made famous back in the, actually in the 90s when they first took pictures with the Hubble, and then they got a new improved version of the pose of creation with, again, with the Hubble. I think it was 2014, and you know, it really came out good. I mean, people had T-shirts with this thing on it. People did, you know, for I guess for wallpaper. You know, very popular picture. Now the James Webb Space Telescope has taken another picture of the Pillars of Creation, and the NASA site had it where, you know, now they showed the details, one picture of it, and then below that they showed a comparison. They had a Hubble picture from 2014, and then the new picture that was taken by the James Webb. So anyway, I sent that over to Roy, and he put it on to his website. So you can see it in two different locations. You can either go to roy.ac2gs.com, or you can go to right now. You can actually go to the NASA site and look at it, look it up before they take it off. But you know, they have, you know, half a dozen topics all the time. Right now, that's one of the topics. But the picture, you can see, I mean, it's completely different. The resolution, the clarity of the picture is just really good. And it's one of the reasons I like it. I remember Dick, K2RIW, used to do this net, like Roy said, since the 1980s. One of the things he was looking forward to was having an A-B test, you know, you know, you have two different pictures, one of Hubble and you know, one of James Webb Space Telescope. I know I've said this on the net before, that he was hoping that Hubble would still be operating. You know, the last service mission took place in 2009, and NASA was hoping for 7 more years. Well, that would have only brought them to 2016. But they did such a good job on that last repair job that all the gyros are still functioning good, the cameras are still working good, the solar panels are still operating, the CPUs are working, the transmitters, everything's going good on Hubble all these years later. So now they're able to do exactly what Dick was hoping for, picture of, you know, of Hubble, well, I mean, from Hubble, taken, you know, a few years ago, 2014, and of course, a picture of James Webb, putting them side by side. Any comments? Any of us that are a little older, you know, that used to follow these rocket launches from NASA, the first ones, you know, we had Mercury, and it was Gemini, and Apollo, you know, if you're, say, what, 69 or older, you were probably one of the people that was sitting in a classroom and they would take a TV and put it into an auditorium. In my case, they would put it at the end of a hallway, and the classes would come out and sit in the hallway and watch these launches, you know, and this went on for the, you know, for all the Mercury flights, and then eventually the first couple of Gemini flights, and of course that all stopped. But you know, the first Gemini flight went up, and that was Grissom Young, and that was successful. That was Gemini 3. But then Gemini 4 was next, and it had two people on board. Commander was James McDivitt, and the pilot was Ed White. And it made such big news because it was going to be the first time the Americans did a spacewalk. And which turned out to be very successful. You know, the Russians did it first. What we didn't know, the Russians, you know, they lie like a son of a gun. Oh, he did great and came back. And, you know, as years went by, we found out that he had nothing but problems trying to get back into the spacecraft. They had a makeshift airlock set up. He couldn't get any help from his partner inside the spacecraft. And this guy, you know, if he wasn't as strong as he was trying to reverse himself and get through this let's call it a hatch. It was really a blow up type of access way that he had to get through. You know, he could have died out there. But the Americans, we did it right. You know, we didn't use an airlock system. They just depressurized the whole vehicle, which meant, you know, the guy staying inside. In that case, it was James McDivitt. And the fellow doing the spacewalk was Ed White. He went outside, and, I mean, he stayed out there for 20 minutes or so. Didn't want to come back in. That's what I'm saying, you know, you got to come back in. And now, we also had the ability to maneuver. He took a nitrogen air gun out with him. And, you know, it had a tank and a little fence. You pull the trigger, and sure enough, you'll go in the opposite direction, you know. And he was able to maneuver. And he did quite well, and he was able to eventually get back inside of Gemini 4. And, of course, they came back, you know, as heroes. Unfortunately, though, this week, James McDivitt has passed away. He made it to 93 years old, and but he's remembered for the McDivitt and White flight, and eventually for Apollo 9, too. He was commander of that. You know, that's the Apollo 9 was the flight where they needed to test the LEM, you know, lunar module, in Earth orbit before they even thought about landing this thing on the moon. So they did that. He went out the Swigert and get the other fellow's name, but. They flew the LEM successfully, separated from the command module, and they gave the command module a name. They called it Gumdrop. This looked like a gumdrop. You took a package of gumdrops years ago. That's what it looked like. And then they called the LEM Spider. And Scott was the other fellow's name. Dave Scott eventually wound up walking on the moon. James McDivitt did not. His last flight was Apollo 9. But they tested that out, made sure everything worked. They even had the whole stack put together. It was the Apollo command module and the LEM itself, and they wanted to test the defense engine when it was attached to see if they could use it as a lifeboat. You know, knowing that, you know, you never know, the main rocket for getting back from the moon might someday fail. And they wanted to know if they could use this descent stage on the LEM as a backup. Not knowing that, you know, a few flights later, Apollo 13 was actually going to have that problem, and sure enough, that's what they did. They used the descent stage to maneuver the whole stack, you know, to eventually get Apollo 13 back safely. Any comments, questions? WS2M. Okay, nothing heard. There's an Electron rocket, and it's not to do electronics, but that's what they call it, the Electron rocket. It's built by Rocket Lab. It's probably flown almost 30 times out of New Zealand, North Island of New Zealand, where Rocket Lab has actually two launch facilities set up there to launch the Electron rocket. Electron rocket, they call it that because they run the turbo pumps with electric motors,
complete,
and lithium ion batteries instead of using exhaust gas from rocket ignition or something of that nature. They don't use that. They actually use the motor to spin it up, and it's cheaper for them to build it that way. It's lighter, and that's what they use. Anyway, they now have taken their Electron rocket and shipped it into Virginia, Wallops Island, Virginia, where they plan on launching this very shortly. They planned on doing this probably a year and a half ago from Wallops Island, Virginia, but the FAA had to give them the okay. It's a whole big long procedure that they have to go through. Basically, the FTS, the flight termination system, has to be evaluated over and over again. You know, if one of these rockets ever got loose and they were unable to destroy it, blow it up, it could theoretically, start go back west and crash into a populated area. So they needed to make sure that, everything was okay with that. The FTS system can either be, well, in this case, they could either manually do it from the ground, or it's going to be also computerized, where if something happens on board, say it starts going off course, going the wrong direction, it will self-destruct without anybody pushing the button on Earth. But looking forward to that. Always good to have, more competition, being able to launch from our soil. Rocket Lab is a company actually an American company. It's owned by a fellow from New Zealand, Peter Beck. But the rockets are manufactured here in the United States, building them in California, and he ships them to New Zealand for launch. In this case, we're going to have to stop shipping them to Virginia. So now he'll have three launch pads to launch from. So I thought that was pretty good. Any comments or questions? Okay, another company called Relativity. Relativity is another rocket company that plans on launching rockets from California and from Florida. And they have something called Terran 1, and it's an American company. It's very similar to the Electron rocket in design. Electron rocket is completely made with a 3D carbon composite system. And this is a much larger rocket that Relativity is building. And they have even bigger robotic systems to make not only the engines in 3D, but the rocket itself. And that will be carbon composite. When you build it with that, they say it's lighter. So if it's lighter, they can send up heavier payloads, and they say it's less expensive too. And the first few, of course, will be actually test flights with the satellites on board. But once they get a hold of idea of what they're doing with this Terran 1, they have another one that they're developing now, which will be reusable. So similar to what SpaceX does, this thing will eventually fly back to the land, and I haven't heard that it's going to be landing on any drones, but it looks like they plan on just bringing the whole booster back to land. And Rocket Lab plans on doing that as well. They have, like I mentioned, the Electron rocket. They are also building the Neutron rocket. nothing to do with neutrons, but that's the name that they're giving it, and that's going to be a much larger rocket than electrons, and that will eventually be reusable as well. Any comments? WS. Okay, just one other quick topic here, and this has to do with India. India has their own space program. They have they launched three different types of rockets now, but over the years they really had two of them. They had the polar satellite launch vehicle, PSLV, and then they have the GSLV, the geosynchronous launch vehicle. That's their larger one, and eventually that will be launching people into space. They still plan on launching a crew into orbit by next year, if they can make that time schedule. But anyway, I bring them up because they just had a launch yesterday, which launched communication satellites by OneWeb. OneWeb is a competitor to SpaceX Starlink system. And they already have over 400 satellites in space. They need around almost 700. And a little different than what SpaceX does with their Starlink. Starlink is, they have a customer base, you know. I mean, you can go out, or I can go out and get one of these terminals, pay $500 for it, and then pay, I think, $150 a month to operate this thing. Whereas OneWeb is a little different. They're selling pretty much to a lot of commercial facilities, not so much individuals, maybe to Viacom, or, you know, to use them as, you know, gateways to, you know, you'll have cell phone traffic here, and then they'll be able to, you know, transmit up to these satellites and go through OneWeb. Have some competition, and, you know, you'll be able to use it in any country. I guess including the Ukraine, you know, that's been in the news a lot lately with Elon Musk, with the problems of, you know, on again, off again communications for Ukraine, and this is one of the ways that he would be able to compete. You know, as years go by, eventually there's going to be other ones as well. Amazon is building a Kuiper satellite system with over 3,000 satellites that they're going to have doing the same thing. So, time marches on, including Eastern Standard Time that I'm looking at here. We're 11:07, 3:07 UTC time. Any last comments before I turn it back to Roy? Nothing heard, but over to you, Roy. AC2GS, WS2N.
Very good. AC2GS here. Thank you, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet report. Thank you for all that you do here on the technical net. Thank you for all that you do with the club. We all appreciate it. And thanks to everyone who participated tonight. We had a whole bunch of interesting discussions. Some of the early ones were actually amateur radio related, but others were life related, which is also important to us all, I hope. Thanks to everyone. Please come back next Sunday when we'll try and do this all over again. Just want to remind people that if you want to reach me via email, the address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. The link page is available 24/7. Articles, YouTube, illustrations, all kinds of fun stuff. Just type into your browser roy.ac2gs.com. And there's an audio stream of the Glen Oaks repeater that's available most of the days of the week. You type in technet.ac2gs.com. And always remember, Mike, AC2NJI has a great archive site. It's called amateurradio.tv. There's over a million visitors to it. It has archives of the Limark Technical Net. It's as far back as September 2006. So once again, have a great week. Have a safe week. Be well. As Dick often closed his technical net, be kind to each other. And as Epictetus used to say, it's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. So be a little bit open to information, You're a little bit doubtful of your own encyclopedic knowledge, and you'll be a more knowledgeable person and a wiser person. So thanks, everyone. Be well. Have a great week. We'll talk again next week. This is AC2GS formally closing this episode of the Limar Technical Net, and I am clear.
I'm still here. You're a little low. I got to turn up the volume here. Yeah, go ahead. WS2N. Okay. A little low and a little noisy for some reason. But, yeah, I'm sure I'll copy you. Okay, a question about radios in space, that's what I heard.
Yeah. Regulations
going around here,
walking through
the air, space. You got a little noise. You want to know what the regulations are? If you, in other words, can you bring a walkie-talkie up into space? Is that the question? Oh, okay. You know, they've had walkie-talkies up in space for decades. Started with the SAREC program, Shuttle Amateur Radio Experiment Program. They actually brought, HD up and started communicating with people out here on Earth with that. And then the first radios that went up on the International Space Station were Motorola modified, but they were used for amateur radio contact. Now they've switched over to Kenwood. They look like mobile rigs. That's what they're using now. They have two of them, one on the Russian side and one on the American side. The American side is located in the Columbus Space Agency module. And on the Russian side, it's located in the functioning cargo block, or it's actually the first module that was sent up by the Russians, when they first started living in it. It's kind of like a machine room now. It's got batteries, all kinds of equipment to help the Russian side of the spacecraft or the space station. Well, that's where they have their 2-meter radio and 440 capability as well. But before that, they had HDs, and and when they transmit, it's one thing we hear them here, but they hear hundreds of stations coming up at one time. Everybody, transmitting at one time. They pick. It's like a contest here. They got the loudest station, and then they work them. Back to you, WS2N.
Wait, one second. Okay, I changed the channel. Yeah, I remember you talked about it. And I remember reading about it.
Talk to somebody about government. I kind of missed that. Back to you.
Yeah, I remember you talking about the continent, but that's one of it. But would you think maybe one of you guys talking to somebody in France, Germany, something?
Wow, I'm on a hard time. heard France. Are we still talking about contact using an HT on the International Space Station? We are, you know, they talk to different countries, you know, around the world. But the AMSAT, part of the ARRL, the AMSAT is, they're in charge of handling the equipment and what goes on with the contacts from space stations to all these, to Earth, ultimately schools, and they've gone through just over 1,000 contacts since the International Space Station has been up there. But I'm not really sure of your question. Again, I'm having a hard time pulling you out for some reason tonight. Back to you.
Okay,
next week. Pretty good, but tonight, for some reason, a little low. I don't know why. And, it's like your audio. It's there, but your audio is low. Anyway, we'll say 73 and have a good night. Thanks for coming back to me. Back to you.
Okay, 72. I really
enjoyed
your show.
Okay, Sandberg. Okay. See, now that I heard clearly, it's weird. Some transmissions were great, the other ones not. All right, 73. Sam, we'll catch you next week, hopefully. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye for now. WS2N0.
Okay.
Is 12:04 a.m. 73 and good night from the W2VL repeater. That's tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
Limark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Limark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Limark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Limark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
This is the W2VL repeater. Good morning. The time is 5:00 a.m.
Limark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater.